Can I just check first? I've always wondered this. Is it Blunston or Blunstone?
It's that own Blunstone. Fuck, you know, someone just asked me that in an email this morning.
Really?
Yeah, it's Blunstone. Apparently, Brian Matthew has been talking about it on, is it Sounds of the Sixties on Radio 2?
Right, okay.
A different way to pronounce my name. But, I mean, listen, I answer to anything.
Okay.
Out of choice, it's Blunstone.
Okay, right, I'll get that right then. Here we go then.
www.themouthmagazine.com.
Colin Blunstone of The Zombies, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Thank you very much, thank you.
How are you, sir?
I'm very well today, thank you. Yes, just been working with Rod Argent over the weekend. We played at St. Albans Cathedral on Friday night.
Oh, wonderful.
And we did one of our acoustic duo shows. It's just the two of us. Although we were joined in the middle by a string quintet for a couple of tunes, but basically we play a two-hour show, just the two of us. It was a sold-out show at St. Albans Cathedral, and it was, you know, a wonderful experience.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well,
yeah.
The Zombies are about to hit the road again, which is great, and we'll talk about that in a little while. But first, let's go back in time to 1969 and the single Time of the Season.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in the sun to promised lands, to show you like me. Has he taken any time
to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
Like me,
has he taken
any time
to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
We'll be right back.
Well, that was The Zombies, the single Time of the Season from 1969. I don't think that was actually released as a single in the UK, was it?
Well, funnily enough, all I would say is it's never been a hit in the UK. It's been a hit in just about every other country in the world. In Cashbox in America, it went to number one. I think in Billboard, it went to about number two. So it was a hit in every other country. It has been released here, but the trouble is, it was so unsuccessful that I think people didn't even realize it had been released as a single. I think it's been released about three times and never got any kind of response at all. So, it always intrigues me how different tracks can be successful in different countries and be totally ignored in other countries. I find that really interesting, you know. And Time of the Season is one of those where it's been a hit in most countries as well, but not in the UK.
As you mentioned, it was a huge hit in America after the band had split, bizarrely. It's one of those instantly recognisable songs, so I do find that quite a surprise that it wasn't a hit here. But anyway, America was pretty big for The Zombies.
Yes, it was indeed. And as a consequence, with this new incarnation of the band, which actually has been playing since 1999, much longer than the original band, so it's Rod Argent and myself and Jim Rodford, Steve Rodford and Tom Toomey, we've been playing since 1999, and a lot of our time is spent touring in the States. As a general rule, we seem to do three quite extensive tours in America every year. So there definitely is a market there. And, of course, we really enjoy playing over there because they have very, very enthusiastic audiences. And it's just, you know, it's great fun.
Well, you were part of what has become known as the British invasion of America in the mid-60s.
That's right. Apparently, we were part of the first wave.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure who was in the second wave, but we were in the first wave.
What was it like to go to the United States in those days?
First of all, I would say that not many people, compared to today, flew intercontinentally. You know, so just to go to America was quite a big deal. But, of course, when we got there, the airport was full of fans. Everywhere we played was sold out with very, very enthusiastic audiences. So for five young boys who were, I think, just 19 at that time, it was a very exciting experience. It's something I'll never forget anyway. It was very, very exciting.
Yeah. Well, you first played there in late 1964. Christmas review show, I think. I'm just looking at the bill for that concert.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fantastic because also playing were the Shangri-Las, the Shirelles, Dionne Warwick, Benny King. That must have been incredible for you.
It was. I mean, it's very, very exciting, but also possibly a little bit intimidating. You know, 6 months earlier, we'd just been playing local gigs around St. Albans, where we originally come from. And here we are, 6 months later, playing with international superstars in the heart of New York.
Mm.
And, of course, we always thought of America as the home of rock and roll. It's where rock and roll, the blues, rhythm and blues, all these things originated in America. So there was a fascination with America, but it came along with a little bit of intimidation as well. We thought, how are people going to respond to us 19-year-old callow youths come over from the UK? But actually, it went incredibly well. The audiences were very responsive, and as you rightly said, we were part of what they considered to be the British invasion, which really helped, I think. But also, the other artists were very supportive as well. And that show took place over Christmas, 1964. And so we were all away from home, all of us, over Christmas. And there was a great camaraderie backstage. The shows, there were about 14 acts on the bill. For the most part, people just played a couple of songs, literally two songs. And the show started at 8 in the morning and went on till about 8 o'clock at night.
8 in the morning?
Yes, it was really strange. And it was packed. Absolutely packed. We opened on Christmas Day and it was packed at 8 o'clock in the morning. And so we were at this theatre, the Brooklyn Fox, for a long time every day. And we got to know the other artists really well because we were all away from, as I said, we were all away from home over Christmas. And we sort of had to make our own amusements and our own festivities backstage and then just nip out on stage and do a couple of tunes, and then you were back to the party afterwards.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful experience.
Excellent. As you say, there are several American tours each year for the Zombies now. So how different do you find the place? Is it an entirely different country to what it was back in 1964?
Well, it is very different, actually. I tell you a place where I can really see the difference, and that's in New York. New York was a pretty tough, aggressive place. When we went there in 64, I definitely wasn't convinced that I would be going back to New York. It was very tough. And I remember on New Year's Eve, Hugh and Chris, the original bass player and drummer, were out in Times Square, and a man was shot dead in front of them by the police. And it's just seemed to be the sort of thing that happened, you know.
Wow.
Pretty traumatic experience. I wasn't there, but it was a tough place. But something happened. It may, you know, some people say it was Mayor Giuliano that changed the atmosphere in New York, and it's a much more relaxed place now. It's a lovely place, New York. And I feel perfectly safe and at home just wandering around and taking in the sights, you know. And it's a very art dominant place, so you feel that it's a good place to be writing music, it's a good place to be going to museums and things like that. So that's lovely. The rest of the country, it's all changed. The South can get a little scary down there sometimes. There's a lot of guns down there.
Right.
Probably my two favourite parts of America is the West Coast. We've driven up from San Diego up to Canada many times, and the whole of the West Coast is absolutely gorgeous. But I like New England as well on the other side. That, in its own way, is equally beautiful as well.
Does it feel kind of a million miles from St. Albans, if you like? From the St. Albans of your youth, let's say.
Well, it's funny because sometimes if you're there for a long time, you almost forget that you're not in the UK, because it is similar, but there are quite big differences. I mean, one is the language. You start to think that you're speaking the same language, but I thought Winston Churchill hit the nail on the head when he said we're two countries divided by a common language.
Yeah.
You can get into awful trouble if you think you're both talking this exactly the same language. It's only little nuances that can confuse the issue, but it can get very confusing when you're talking to Americans sometimes.
Let's talk about an early single for the Zombies, the debut single, in fact, She's Not There, which is another song that's had a great afterlife. And in fact, we're going to play out with that song in a few minutes' time. Santana covered it in the mid-70s, I think. Obviously, you've had a long and successful career in music, so the innocence of youth, if you like, of being outside of the business may seem difficult to remember, but I wondered if you remembered what it was like leading up to putting that record out.
Oh, I do. I remember it vividly, yeah. We'd entered into a big rock and roll competition. It was called we lived in Hertfordshire, and it was called the Heartbeat Competition, which sounds a bit tame, but there were hundreds of bands went into this competition, and to our amazement, we won. And I think that changed everyone's outlook. It certainly changed my outlook to the band, because I loved playing in the band, and I would have loved to have become a professional musician, but I didn't think really the opportunity was there. I wasn't sure that we were good enough. I didn't know if anyone would be interested in us. But when we won that competition, I started to think, well, maybe there's an opportunity for us here. And it led indirectly to a record contract with Decca.
Mm.
And we were introduced to a producer called Ken Jones. And I remember having a conversation with Ken about 2 weeks before we were going to go into this Decca studios. And he said, you know, we're going to do some old R&B classic tunes, but he said you could always write something for this session. And then he went on and talked about other things. I didn't think that much about the whole conversation. But Rod went away and wrote She's Not There. And he came back about 48 hours later and he said, look, I've written a song. What do you think? And I think Rod and I knew, but I think we all knew in the band that it was something special, that song was really a special song. And it was maybe only because of that chance comment by Ken Jones, you could always write something for this session. I don't know if Rod would have done it otherwise.
Yeah. And I guess I guess history could have been different entirely for the zombies.
My life certainly would have been totally different.
Yeah.
Because it changed everything. We recorded it in the spring of 64. I know it was released on July the 24th, 1964. So we would have recorded it about 2 or 3 months beforehand. And it was a very interesting session in that the recording engineer had been at a wedding all day. We went in the evening, and he was absolutely and completely drunk and very aggressive. And I really thought that the recording industry was not for me, because this guy was a real handful. But then we had a bit of luck, and he passed out cold on the floor. And we had to carry him out and put him in a black London taxi. And his assistant took over, and his assistant was called Gus Dudgeon.
Oh.
And Gus went on to be one of the most famous producers in the world, particularly working with Elton John, but Kiki D, David Bowie, all sorts of people. That was Gus's first session. When the original engineer passed out, Gus took over, and he finished up the recording of She's Not There.
So you also have massive thanks to give to the couple that got married that day, I think.
Maybe we do, yes. I never heard what happened to them. I never heard what happened to the engineer who passed out either.
Okay.
Anyway, She's Not There, had a life of its own, I suppose. It's still played regularly all around the world, and I think it's a song that everyone recognises.
Yeah, definitely. I'm guessing back then you were 18, 19, as you say, the business side of the music business would be pretty alien to you, I think. So obviously you'll have been through that machinery over the years. If there's anything that you could tell the young Colin, the Colin of 1964, what might it be?
Do you know, I remember Rod and I sitting with one of the Isley brothers, Rudy Isley it was, and him telling us, because they were a bit older than us, and him telling us to, you know, check everything, don't trust anyone, keep records of everything. And everything you said was true.
Mm.
And of course, like all young people, we thought we didn't need to take any notice of all that. And we were mercilessly ripped off, except for record royalties. We were with a wonderful company that were completely honest, and publishing royalties. But for all our live concerts, I'm afraid we were absolutely terribly ripped off, as most 60s bands were.
Yeah.
And I mean, I suppose all you can say is use your common sense. If there's 2,000 people in the audience paying 20 quid a ticket, you know, it's quite easy to work out there's a bit of money in the till, and you've just got to try and keep on top of it. And don't get overwhelmed by the fast-talking agent who'll give you some cock-and-bull story. Really, a lot of it is common sense. And if you're signing a contract, make sure you understand that there is an end date on that contract. If it's a 3-year contract, make sure it ends at the end of 3 years, because often, if you're a successful band, people will try and take up options and keep involved in your career for longer than you thought was going to happen. And so certainly make sure, never mind about how much you're going to earn, the most important thing is when does it end?
Yeah.
But of course, yeah, it's important how much you're going to earn as well. But in the main fault, just talking about specifics that we suffered from, it's something called double selling, where it's quite straightforward in a way. An agent will negotiate with a promoter, and to use round figures, he'll agree £1,000 fee with the promoter.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll tell the band that he only got 500.
Right, yeah.
And he'll then also take he gets 1,000, he pays you 500, and then he'll take his percentage, whatever that is, out of your 500 as well, which sort of adds insult to injury, really. But that's what was happening with us. We were being double sold. As I say, once you know about it, it's quite simple to spot. But us being 18 or 19 years old, we didn't know. And consequently, at the end of 3 years on the road, the three non-writers, which would be me, Paul Atkinson and Hugh Grundy, we were pretty much broke.
Yeah.
They were with a different company for their publishing, were quite comfortably off.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier Time of the Season. We heard that earlier, in fact. That was on the Odyssey and Oracle album, the 1968 album. Paul Weller is a notably huge fan of that album, which is an amazing endorsement.
Yes, I know. I mean, I'm absolutely thrilled at the support he's given us with regard to that album. And when we first played the album in its entirety about 5 years ago at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, we were going to play for one night, and it sold out so quickly we ended up playing three nights.
Mm.
And Paul came to all three nights.
Really?
And came backstage afterwards, and was fantastic. You know, such a lovely bloke. Really great bloke.
Is it?
You know, the Zombies have been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the States. This is our second nomination, actually. So we'll have to wait and see. And I think a lot of that is based on the success of Odyssey and Oracle. It was named as in Rolling Stone as one of the top 100 albums of all time, which is quite an accolade, really. And I think that's helped to sort of cement our reputation in America. And as I say, we've been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for, what would that be, 2017, next year. So it'll be great if we're inducted. I think that will be absolutely wonderful.
And maybe they can get Paul to present you with it.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Of course.
Yeah,
that would be absolutely fantastic.
I'm thinking about that album. Legend has it that it was relatively difficult to make. There was a tension between you and Rod at that point.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there was a tension when we recorded Time of the Season. I mean, all of any kind of tension is just normal artistic tension. There's nothing deep going on. Time of the Season was the last track we recorded, and we were under a lot of pressure. We had a very, very small budget. That's where the difficulty was. I think CBS gave us £1,000, which even in those days wasn't very much to make an album. And we managed to get into Abbey Road. To my knowledge, we were the first non-EMI artist to get into Abbey Road, because Abbey Road was owned by EMI, and it was exclusively used by EMI artists. I don't know how we got in there, but it was the place to be then. It's still a wonderful studio now, but it was quite expensive. And the difficulty was, you know, we had the small budget, so we had to rehearse the whole album really extensively, so that when we went into the studio, we knew the arrangement and the keys that we were going to record in. All we were looking for was the performance.
Yeah.
We didn't go into the studio and work things out in the studio. It was all done outside of the studio. So there was a bit of tension, because we were clock watching, because we had such a small budget. Time of the Season was the last track we recorded, and it had only just been written. And this is where the struggle was. I didn't really know the song. And Rod was being very patient in the control room and saying to me, you know, I'm out in the studio and talking through headphones, and he's saying, no, Colin, it's not quite right. The melody goes a bit like this. I've got my eye on the clock, knowing we're going to run out of time. And it got quite fiery, actually. And I've always laughed at the irony in that. It's a song where the lyric is going, it's the time of the season for loving. And at that particular time, Rod and I were at one another's throats trying to get this track finished. But I'm so glad that, you know, I stood there and got it right in the end, because it went on to sell about 2 million copies.
Yeah.
As we've said previously, it never sold in any numbers in this country, but worldwide it was actually our biggest hit record.
Yeah. How does the resurgence of interest in the band feel to you 50 years on from those early days?
Well, it's fascinating to me. Rod and I got back together again in 1999 to play six concerts, very definitely no more, just six concerts. We enjoyed it so much, and we got such a great response, we just kept going. But for years, there was no thought of calling the band The Zombies. When we first started out in this incarnation of the band, we didn't play many zombie tunes, to be honest. We certainly didn't call the band The Zombies. But we quickly realized that there's a huge interest. I think there's a bit of a mystique about the band, maybe because the band finished before their biggest success, which was Odyssey and Oracle and Time of the Season. Maybe it's something to do with that. But there is a kind of mystique about the band, and we didn't realize that existed until we got back out on the road. And we were encouraged by audiences to play more and more Zombies tunes, till it got to a point about 5 or 6 years ago, we realised that we were playing a Zombies concert.
Yeah.
Nearly all the tunes, with few exceptions, were Zombie tunes. We sat down and talked to the surviving original members, Chris White and Hugh Grandy, and said, look, it would seem the logical thing to start calling this band the Zombies, and, you know, how do you feel about that? And they said, fine, you know. They were thrilled that we were reactivating the catalogue, that Zombie songs were being heard again. So from about 5 or 6 years ago, we became the latest incarnation of the Zombies, and it is fascinating that there's such a deep worldwide interest in the Zombies. It's completely taken me by surprise, but it's a lovely surprise.
Yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
a great surprise to have after all this time. People talking about songs that we recorded 50 years ago,
yeah.
more than 50 years ago. And you think, how on earth do you know about that song? I can hardly remember it myself. And but some of these songs we've had to literally relearn because we've recorded them 50 years ago, sometimes hardly ever played them live. And now people are asking for us to play them. And, of course, it's a pleasure and it's a thrill for us to get this kind of encouragement and support.
I guess that's testament to the strength of the songs, really, because there is something special goes on, actually, when you and Rod have worked together.
Well, it's nice to think that, isn't it? And it would
yeah.
be... It would be reinforced by the fact that we have been quite successful doing these acoustic duo concerts. We've done them all over America and all over the UK. We started off, someone asked us to do it. It was almost, you know, it was just a bit of a dare maybe, you know, just a bit of a laugh. But it's built up to, we've played some very prestigious places and some quite big places as well. So I think there is a bit of magic when Rod and I play together. And especially when he writes, he will always say that subconsciously he's writing for my voice. Also, that he learned to write songs writing for my voice, whereas I learned to sing professionally singing his songs. So there is, you know, there's a 50-year connection between Rod and I, and you can't, there's no shortcut to that kind of connection,
no,
you know.
No.
If you've been playing together off and on, there's been gaps, but off and on for 50 years, there's no substitute for that. It means it's a very special relationship.
To round up, Colin, what's next after these forthcoming dates? You're working on a new solo album, I think. Is that right?
I am. I just started. I'm collecting songs and I will be recording tracks for a new solo album. Hopefully get some tracks done before Christmas. So the interesting thing is that the Zombies and myself as a solo artist, we've never been so busy as we are now, which, of course, all musicians long for that situation because we all love to work. And here we are touring the world. The Zombies are doing nearly 2 months, starting in March in 2017. And we are, for the last time, we're going to be doing concerts where we will feature the whole of Odyssey and Oracle played by the original band. Next year will be the last time. It's the 50th anniversary of the recording of Odyssey and Oracle. It was actually recorded in 1967, although it was released certainly in America a little bit later. So it's the 50th anniversary, and I think that will be it then, once we've done that tour. I think we're going to bring it to the UK in the autumn, although nothing's confirmed as yet.
Okay, well, look forward to the solo album, and good luck with the dates. Colin Blunston, thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's Blunstone.
It is.
And thanks very much for having me on the show.
Let's play out with She's Not There.
Fantastic. All the very best.
Thank you, Colin. Sorry about that slip at the end there.
I thought it was really funny. We were talking about that at the beginning, weren't we?
Yeah, we were. We were. Excellent.
Caught you out.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked. The way she had
could I do? Well, no one told me about love, though they all knew. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she acted, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and good, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there. Don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she acted, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there.
www.themouthmagazine.com